Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show, our 115th show, coming to you from the new fxguide.com. I say the new fxguide.com because we have a brand new website over at fxguide.com. It's the old FX Guide you know and love, completely redone and revamped. If you haven't seen it, it's only just launched. We've had a team working out of our Chicago office for weeks on this, and we're very, very proud. Well, actually, months, I should say. We're really, really proud of it, and it's just the tip of the iceberg of stuff that's coming. So I hope you'll check that out. Joining me this week in this giant of a show to discuss Gulliver's Travels is one Matt Graham. How are you, sir?
I'm fine and dandy. Thank you very much.
and also Ian Fales. How are you, Ian?
Good, Mike. How you doing?
So let's start, as we always do, by discussing the film and what we thought of it, and then we'll get into the visual effects, which, of course, this week will centre around the idea of miniaturisation and scale. And I guess I'm going to start by asking you, Matt, who do you think this film was aimed at, and did you like it?
I think it was aimed at kids, because I figured they got halfway through and realised, well, maybe we don't need to make the best-looking effects to actually sell a film, and maybe we can get away with digital dimensionalising the film and not worry so much about polishing.
And the dimensionalising was done, you think, for the kids' benefit?
I think it was done for the benefit of not being such a polished film in other aspects, and cashing in on the fact that you're going to get more money for the ticket at the box office by dimensionalizing it, and gimmick for the kids.
Right.
I mean, you don't see many kids' films these days that are in 2D.
But isn't that partly in influenced by the fact that if you're doing a you're doing a fully animated film, it's easier to make it stereoscopically and make it stereoscopically successful. Do you think that's a kids' film property or an animated feature property? Because surely the 3D market's dominated by animated features.
Yeah, but I mean, things like Yogi Bear and stuff, they have 3D characters in it, sure, but they're pushing this whole 3D for kids thing. I think kids' films are driving part of the 3D market.
Yogi Bear?
I regretfully haven't, and I don't think I'll be seeing it anytime soon.
Okay. So just in terms of a film then, you were down on the visual effects. Were you down on the film as well?
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't the greatest thing. I mean, Jack Black doing another singing number near the end just to make blood drip from my ears was just not necessary. I mean, it had some really funny bits, and I thought the acting overall was great from all the support cast. But, I wasn't running to see this film.
Ian, what did you think?
Well, I didn't mind the film, actually. I have to disagree with you, Matt, a little bit. The only thing I guess I didn't like about it was that it was mainly just gags. So a lot of the funny stuff comes from the scale jokes, massive iPhone and a lot of those sort of humour gags. When you go and watch it, you're kind of probably only watching it for Jack Black. It's a bit of a Jack Black vehicle. It's definitely not faithful to Gulliver's Travels, the novel, and it's not intended to be. But, I sat there laughing at a lot of those gags.
It's definitely aimed at kids. And whilst sometimes I'm a big kid, it wasn't doing it for me as much as some other films that have come out recently.
So it scored poorly with critics. It scored a little better with audiences, but not greatly. It's definitely in the tourist little fockers end of the critical timeline, and certainly not at the King's Speech Inception end of the timeline. But I mean, I guess for me, I saw it with my kids. They thought it was funny. I was a little sort of perplexed as to the age group that it was aimed at. I think it's probably aimed at what you might call tweens. That's, beyond little kids that would be going to see something that was just a straight Disney kind of G, but below a teenage crowd that would probably find it slightly embarrassing. It certainly lacked any of the kind of sophistication that you could put into what has become that sort of teenage kids film, like a Harry Potter, which is incredibly sophisticated. But let's discuss visual effects, because we're mainly here about the visual effects, and I think the visual effects are worth discussing, even if you thought the film sucked. And I think that there are two aspects of the visual effects that are really distinctively different, and that's the opening title sequence and the rest of the film. There's also the fact that this film was stereoscopically, I think it's one you already mentioned, it was, post-filming converted to be a stereoscopic film, and we should probably touch on that, though we did discuss that quite a lot over I'm mental blanking. Narnia, which of course was very successfully done. We've touched on it. Let's keep going. I actually thought this wasn't as well converted to stereo as Narnia. I thought Narnia like basically ran rings around it for stereo conversion. What did you guys think?
I agree with you. There wasn't really any need to have it stereo converted. I think, you know, there weren't those kind of sequences maybe like in Narnia where it sort of added to the story. And sort of when you were watching it when he wasn't in Lilliput, it just felt a bit wrong in New York City. It didn't feel right. And I don't actually mean the opening titles, but we'll get to that later. But shots of him in his apartment and at the newspaper just didn't feel right as stereo scenes.
Could you say that this film compared to Narnia, it's not quite as classy as Narnia? You know, Narnia has a class to it, whereas this, you know, it's going to be a slapstick comedy kind of thing. And that, I don't know, it felt like it was more pushed as a last minute thing. The production was delayed. The release of the film was delayed several times in the last 6 months leading up to it. And I think they rushed to put the dimensionalization into it, and it was an afterthought and not as polished as Narnia, whereas they really wanted to make sure they had a long-lasting, sexy-looking film.
I guess there's two things. I totally agree with you on the classy thing, or the sort of visual sophistication. And I think it lacked any of the things like the, for example, the dragon or the particle work that we saw in Narnia that really singled that out. I guess for me, there's two things. Firstly, this seems to me like a direct-to-video. This is the sort of thing that you watch on DVD. This is not a film that you want to rush to the cinema for. The only thing that could have made it something that you want to rush to the cinema for is if they had done some incredibly clever stereo. Because the whole point about stereoscopic work, as most of you are listening would know, we have obviously 64 millimeters between your two eyes. And so you view the world with those parameters. If you vastly increase the distance between the two cameras, in other words, you make the distance between the left and the right eye cameras that are actually filming something much, much bigger, like I'm talking several meters, then your brain perceives what was ever filmed by those cameras as being a miniature because, clearly your brain says, well, my eyes are always the same distance apart. No matter what I do, I can never move my eyes either vertically offset from each other or further apart. So the only way I can rationalize the thing that I'm looking at is it must have been really small. So if I look at a mountain shot with several meters apart on stereoscopic cameras, my brain says, this must be a miniature because clearly my brain says the only way that that can compute with the fixed distance between my eyes, which it assumes to be have not varied, is that what I'm looking at is smaller and not obviously that it was the right size and my eye or my head expanded. Now, if you could have taken that and totally made that this thing where we were perceiving the small world from the eyes of a giant and the giant was perceived from the eyes of somebody that was seeing something with almost no parallax shift because, of course, something way off in the distance doesn't have much, you could have got a really, really interesting stereo film out of this. And the example I offer in my defense, Your Honor, is the opening bloody title sequence. Because I saw the opening title sequence and went, oh, this is going to rock. This is going to way exceed my expectations on this film. This is going to be incredible. I mean, if you can make New York look like that, then wow. And then we hit the rest of the film and it was like, well, you know, Jack Black's the star, so we'd like quite a lot of volume on him, even though the big thing should have less volume because they'll have less stereo effect. And the little guys, we're not going to amp them into looking like ants because that doesn't make it look kind of real. And you ended up with this kind of very vanilla stereo. Would you guys agree?
Oh, I totally agree. And of course, the reason is that those opening titles were shot in stereo.
Well, talk to us about that because they were magnificent. Who the heck did them and who the heck do we throw our applause to?
That would be Rocket Studio.
Okay.
And they're in LA. And basically, they were working on those shots for about 9 months.
9 months.
Yeah.
Now what proportion of that was actually working on them, or what proportion was it was just in revision for 9 months?
Oh, I'm not exactly.
Were they actually working on them for like? Did it take a long time to do them, or was it just that they kept on revising them?
I don't think it took a long time to do it, but they were researching it for a while, and there was actually initially only four people, I understand, working on it at that studio. So what they did was that they sort of researched, because, you know, if you haven't seen the film, it's got that sort of tilt-shift look, and the actual opening titles, say the characters' names and the filmmakers' names, appear in certain New York locations.
So it's shots of New York, normally from above, mm-hmm. looking down, and it looks like a miniature. Mm-hmm. It's sped up, so it has that kind of wrong speed feel, which makes, of course, water look like it's smaller. If you slow down water, you make it scale up. If you speed it up, it looks like a puddle. And the people were all moving around in kind of Legoland feel. And you're saying that was actually stereoscopically shot, not converted.
That's right. It's shot with two Canon Mark IVs.
You mean 1D Mark IVs?
1D Mark IVs. Yep. And they did a post-tilt shift effect to it, you know, to get the blur right. But they had a special rig that they took to New York and shot, you know, from certain locations and from helicopters. You know, one of the issues that when I was talking to the guys there, they said they had was syncing up the two cameras. And, you know, they had a bit of trouble when they put it on that high burst mode that the cameras have, you know, basically trying to press the button at the same time. So what they did was they went to, I think it was Radio Shack, and got some kind of circuit board controller and somehow bypassed the automatic shutter and were able to sync up the cameras that way.
Okay, because that's really interesting, because the normal problem with trying to use, say, a couple of 5Ds for doing stereo work is there is no sync feed, there is no time code, there is no genlock, so you can't fire them simultaneously. Now, of course, if you're doing time lapse, you could get close, but they went beyond close to exact by basically hacking the cameras.
That's right.
That'd be funny. Can I borrow your 1D? Yeah, sure. Do you mind if I just take this side panel off?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's exactly how they do it. And I think the other thing that they found when they were doing it was by only having that rig and, you know, SLRs, was that they had a pretty small footprint. So they weren't a huge camera crew. They could get in and out of locations pretty quickly. And that meant, you know, they could just shoot tons and tons of material before taking it back to a rocket and doing the work on it.
But they had a lot of monitoring problems, didn't they? Because just shooting on the SLRs, they didn't have any stereo monitoring, so they were kind of shooting blind. Maybe that is one of the reasons why it led to such a long time of testing stuff.
There is sort of a rig like they're doing, because they actually had them further apart, right? Like that felt like it was a miniature, so they must have had the intraocular, the separation between the two lenses quite big. So it must have been a custom rig, because there's no sort of off-the-shelf SLR stereo rig, simply because SLRs are so crap at doing stereo.
That's right. I think they had the ability in that rig to separate them from between 3 inches to 3 feet, you know, and that was because they had also big lenses on them, you know, for some occasions. So, yeah, they definitely built their own rig and...
See, I'd have liked to have seen that, like, 3 meters apart, because I would have liked to have seen it. Well, I guess the scale. Did anyone feel that the scale of Jack Black to the Lilliputians was somewhat variable? Was that just me?
I thought there was a lot of variables in all that miniature kind of stuff later on.
But it would have been, if you were to look at him in any of the publicity shots, for example, and try and compare the size of his head to those around him, it felt to me like they were at least, 12 feet apart? I mean, like if one of the guys was lying down and you assume they were about 6 feet, I don't think they would have totally spanned his eyeballs. So that felt like it was maybe sort of somewhere definitely over 6, maybe 12 feet difference between his actual eyes. So if you were to do the right stereo for him, you'd have placed the two lenses at least 12 feet apart. 3 feet seems a little shallow, but I guess for sheer logistics, getting things further than about 3 feet apart, which is actually quite a way, 3 feet. It's like at least about a bit over a meter for those of us in the metric new world. So they shot that stuff raw, did they?
They shot it raw.
So that must have been like really high res, therefore, as well.
I think they had 8K plates after, you know, doing that. And, you know, and then the process was adding the right blur and tilt shift to it, which they, I think, used After Effects and a number of the ways to do it. And then, of course, they had to add in the lettering, the typeface. And so there was sort of two ways you would have noticed if you saw the titles. There's sort of graffiti on walls, that's more of a matte painting approach reprojected in Nuke. But then there's also 3D lettering, which was done in Maya. And, you know, occasionally there's traffic and people interacting with those letters, so a fair bit of roto and other work involved there. So I actually think that was a really great start to the movie, like you said, Mike, but then maybe didn't pay off for the rest of the film.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just stood out that it was insanely different from the rest of the film, but it was so excitingly good that it kind of really whet your appetite. Tell me, Wasn't there something to do with how they had to do Central Park? Because I think you were telling me before we came on air that it was... I thought this was shot on Genesis, but you were saying only some of it was shot on Genesis and most of it was on SLRs.
Most was on SLR. They shot a few shots on Genesis for when it's near the end of the titles and they needed to transition to the real film. For the Central Park one, which is actually the main Gulliver's title, Gulliver's Travels titles, they went up in a helicopter and it turns out that President Obama was in New York that day. And apparently the rule is you can't fly over New York while his convoy is below you. So instead of shooting the plate that they wanted, they actually had to shoot multiple plates of Central Park and then piece it together, you know, via projection methods later on.
I thought it worked well. Were you aware, Matt, of any difference between the Central Park stuff and the previous stuff? I guess the...
No,
the,
it didn't stand out. I mean, obviously, other than having a bigger title in the
middle. And it didn't have the kind of moving, people-y stuff that we saw. Like, some of the stuff down near the water looked really good just because of these sort of ebb and flow of little people.
Yeah, I think the director wanted to make you think the first couple of shots were a miniature model and all cool. And then slowly, as you go through the credit sequence, you start noticing more people in it, and which kind of give it away as being a live-action shot thing. I mean, I thought they would have just done shift and tilt lens, thanks for coming, nice and easy opener.
But shift really, and tilt stereo?
I wasn't too sure how the hell they did it, but I just thought, okay, cool. But I was so impressed to find out that they went through all these different techniques and really approached each shot.
Shift and tilt lenses. In fact, I don't think you could. I think that would be the problem. I don't think you could actually align the shift and tiltness because that's a mechanical on the lens.
Well, unless you shot it mono and then dimensionalized it.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Dimensionalize a shift and tilt. Well, then you'd have, yeah.
They've come up with some amazing approaches just to have more control in post. I mean, they chose this method of putting the shift and tilt in post because they had more control. When people are interacting with bench park seats that are supposed to be part of people's titles and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, remember you and I shot with that shift and tilt with Tyler in Yellowstone.
Yeah.
And they're great lenses, but I just think that it would be impossible to calibrate them left to right. Or at least you probably could, but it would be like really hard. I don't know how you'd go about doing it because they're just so...
The dimensionalization of it, you're just running into another pile of problems. Really clever ways of getting around it, though.
I don't think the post effect of the shift and tilt... I didn't feel like you were missing anything. You do get a different look when you shift and tilt in post than you do in cameras, no matter how hard you try. And the original is awesome, but I think for the complexity it would have added, it would have been a nightmare. But yeah, I agree. I thought it was really good. And I actually missed the some of that interaction stuff you were talking about with the letters and the park benches and stuff. So I'm glad you mentioned that because I had read about that, but I hadn't seen it. I was just blown over by just how cool it looked, in contrast to the rest of the serial, which I thought was pretty bland. Now, this is a Fox film, isn't it?
That's right.
Do we know who dimensionalized it?
I think it was a combination of a couple of companies, IEFX, Rocket Science, and Stereo D.
Yeah, I think Stereo D, it's got it on their homepage, and they look like they were one of the major providers, according to IMDb and all that kind of stuff.
I think at the moment I'd have to say Disney is the best at their stereo pipelines. And, of course, by saying Disney, you also encompass Pixar because they're part of that now. And that kind of pushes them way over the edge. And I also think that Narnia excelled beyond what we'd seen. So this is like, you know, three steps forward, one step backwards a bit with this film. So, let's leave the stereo for a second and just go, which, I mean, as I say, was just a disappointment because it could have been awesome and it could have made a real reason for wanting to see this in a cinema versus just a DVD. I mean, this is a sort of film that I would be happy to see on a flight from Sydney to London when I'm only going to see it in a beach, in a sort of a seat kind of flip-up screen, and I go, well, yeah, I'm not going to miss anything by only seeing this in crap vision. Because I was there for the Jack Black jokes. Though, even the Jack Black jokes seemed... Is it just me, or do you think that Jack Black is... he was absolutely awesome in some of his earlier films. I mean, completely just insanely great. High Fidelity, for example, was just... But nowadays, I almost feel like they're asking Jack Black to do Jack Black, and Jack Black's going, okay, I have to do Jack Blackness. All right, I'll do it on cue if you want. You sometimes see him in interviews, and it's almost like someone asks him a question, and you can see, yeah, what they want is the funny guy answer, so I'll give them the funny guy
Well, he was one of the producers of the film. So I think he was really... He chose this project and I think wanted to, you know, have another Jack Black project, I guess. I mean, he's done a lot of his own work for the last couple of years. So it's an interesting one for him to choose to pursue.
Yeah.
Maybe he was hoping more for technology to get it right and get it across the line. I think the 3D definitely, you know, being a late choice... They announced it was going to be 3D back in June, which is when it was supposed to be released.
Okay.
And I don't know. I think the 3D, seeing it in 3D probably would have helped a little bit of some of the comps, trying to get the scale right between the little people and the giant. Having that kind of card feel, because it's so hard getting that scale right, isn't it? I mean, making sure you've got the depth of field to really sell the big thing in the background and the foreground being, you know, at the right blur as well. And
I think some shots worked better than others.
Yeah.
And there's a variety of people contributing, right? Because obviously there was, four or five companies? Scanline, Weta, Hydraulics, and Method. Was there anyone else that I missed?
There's a couple of Indian companies, Geon, and another one called Tata, and Pixel Playground as well.
So,
and maybe some others.
So what was our favourite sequence of large and small interacting in terms of visual effects? So obviously there was a lot of green screen to pull that off, but do we think any of them particularly worked well or not?
I thought the Armada sequence when Jack Black takes on that Navy was really good.
Yeah.
Because the scale was right. It was in really clear. It was beautiful water simulations. And this was all work done by Weta, who actually came on pretty late in the show.
The water sim was gorgeous, actually.
Mm.
Did they use the stuff that they used on Avatar for that? Because that was the Exotic Media NIAID guys.
They did, and they're sort of using that in conjunction with their Synapse system.
Because the Narnia shot, when they send out word to the rest of the tribes and they have a shot going down the coast and they're flying and the waves are crashing on the edge of the shore. And
it's in Avatar,
like
you mean?
Yeah, in Avatar. Yep. And this is like one shot. I mean, that was the shot that I was like, oh, my God, this is like...
That was amazing, that shot.
Yeah. The water in that just was off the dial good. Even though it was the sipping from the water shot that got them the best VES award for individual shots. And so it makes, I guess, complete sense that you get Weta to do the water sim stuff for him. Interestingly, while I think that was great, like, and I think it was really, really good water sims, to a certain extent, I thought it worked better. There's a scene where he's walking along and the other guy, whose name escapes me for a second, from...
is it Horatio or something?
Horatio,
thank you, is running along the rooftops. And that's had a really nice look to it. The 3D was really nice. The visual effects were really nice. It just felt kind of warm and well composed, and the scale seemed good. Who did that one?
I think the foreground of that looked really good.
It did, yeah.
But the background didn't look as good.
Oh, really?
The end where you get to that corner of the building, and this happened in a couple of the other shots, the matte paintings just looked flat. There was no projection. You had a couple of little puffs of smoke coming out of chimneys in the background, but for me, the foreground looked great. The background, not so great.
Do you mean stereoscopically or visually?
Visually.
Okay, I thought it looked pretty good.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I thought that one was pretty good. Method, I think, was behind that one.
Right.
You saw his shirt colours on the building and stuff. And, yeah, the interaction in the foreground, Jack Black and Horatio, was great. It's just the matte painting on the background of that one didn't do it for me as well. Same when he's at nighttime talking to the princess. Again, you would have had a practical foreground for her to be leaning against. And then you just had this kind of stuck on matte painting behind him. It just, I don't know, felt a bit rushed on those ones.
I think I agree with you that one there. I wanted to pick up something Mike said before, was that there seemed to be really, really good shots and then some not so good ones. Mm. And it may well be because they had a few different approaches to it. You know, there's one really, really great shot when Jack Black or Gulliver's tied up and he's sort of coming close to the palace and there's sort of a helicopter pan around him.
Yep.
I just thought that worked really well.
Yeah,
you know, and I can only assume that they shot the live action at Blenheim Castle in Oxfordshire,
mm-hmm.
and then Jack Black on green screen. And you know, that was one shot that worked really well. But
is
there
that
were just
the first one you see?
I think it's one of the first ones you see.
Yeah, because yeah. I mean, when I first saw that, it stood out, and I was like, "Wow, that looks really cool." And then I noticed the people on the ground, and they looked not so good for me. They seemed a bit washed out and just, I don't know, it was tracked in nicely. Just they didn't seem to sit in color-wise. But the rest of it was awesome.
Yeah. And, you know, there's just other approaches that they took to the shots of Jack Black with buildings or with people, say in the Lilliput Times Square, where, you know, they're shooting them separately on green screen. And then, you know, I've read that occasionally they shot with sort of a slaved motion control rig, where they would shoot the live action. And
so I've just got to tell you an anecdote. When I was in a Flame Artist, this guy came to me once with a script and he said, I've got this miniature building that I built, right, a real miniature building, and I want to put it into a helicopter shot of an area where we're going to actually build this building. And I was like, uh-huh. And he said, so what I want to do is I've got this helicopter shot going around the big hole in the ground and I've got the miniature. And what I thought I'd do is I'd film walking around the miniature and then I'd just track and composite that into the helicopter shot of walking around the building. And I said, well, that'll never work. And he was like, well, why not? I said, well, because the camera motion will change in perspective on the building as you move closer to it and further away, up or down. And that perspective, while I could morph it and warp it to work on a still shot, on a moving sequence, will just never work. Like if I track and did 2D tracking for the base, so I could nail the foreground plate to the base, then that'd be great. But the whole building would then sway. And if I didn't do that, then, you know, you'd just be in trouble. And the only way to solve this would be to either make a 3D building or to take photos of your model, then build a 3D building and then stick it in. But just trying to match these two plates, it'll never work. Okay, fine. Meeting's over, right? About a month later, I'm sitting in the suite. Mike, we just want you to come downstairs to offline. Yep. Walk in the room. And they, like, had exactly that on the screen. So it's not working. And I said, well, yeah, I said it wouldn't work. And they said, yeah, and I thought you meant it would be, like, hard. And I went, no, I said it wouldn't work. And they said, what? You meant that? And I was like, yeah, I meant that. Well, you have to fix it. I said, no, I don't think you understand. It's just a problem that can't be solved. And they're like, you can do anything in visual effects. I said, yes, just not this way. And they were like, well, we've shot it now. You should have said. And I'm sorry, didn't I say this will never work? And they're like, well, we're completely, you're just going to have to solve it. And, of course, the only thing I could do, which was literally make up 10 different stills that all worked, and then we just dissolved between the stills as a kind of a creative montage. But this is the look on this guy's face. It's like, what, you meant that? And it's like, yeah, damn it. But the problem that I'm illustrating with this anecdote is that problem that if you've got Jack Black filmed and you've got a miniature helicopter shot, you've got to derive the motion from the miniature helicopter shot, because otherwise you have to completely rebuild the geometry that the helicopter shot shot. And somehow you then have to scale that into a camera move on Jack Black. But you're simply assuming Jack Black to make Jack Black look good is not going to match into a helicopter plate of Blenheim Castle, no matter how hard you try, without one of the two of them being basically re-projected or, you know, camera mapped, projected to solve a problem. And so that idea of doing that and then doing a scaled motion control actually produces a good result. But it's actually considerably more complicated than it first looks like. A simple green screen comp of Jack Black over a background plate of a castle, if the camera's moving on the castle shot, actually requires a fair amount of smarts on how you shoot Jack Black in the first place. And I didn't have any perspective problems like that. I thought that they kind of lined up pretty well. Now, my problem is completely different to that. And I don't know if you guys got this or not, but I think we discussed this once before in a previous show. But if you look at Jack Black's material, he lands on an island and he's wearing a pair of board shorts and a T-shirt, let's say, right? And then he gets a series of outfits made for him. Now, here's the thing. Is the threads made to be giant? And if they are, they produce these things about the size of, I don't know what you'd call them really, like the cables that hold yachts, I mean, major container ships to wharfs kind of threads, and therefore wove his clothes. And if that's the case, he has weave of the right scale for him as a giant, which is fine. I can accept that in the throwaway reality world we're in, that they did that. The problem then is that you get this thing where you don't scale well between the miniatures and the big, because unlike, say, Tooth Fairy or a number of other films like that, the material didn't scale. The material was like correct weave density for a small person and correct weave density for a large person. And that lack of stiffness that you get. Like, if you ever look at dolls' clothes, not that I play with dolls.
They made him a coffee percolator. You're worried about the threads of his clothing. No, but
and a house. No, they made him a house, too.
I'm not worried about the house. I'm just saying, like, when you get a shot of a miniature person, and, like, when he goes to the giant...
I hear what you're saying, but sometimes you just have to... Let the world
no,
go.
No, but this is a visual
sometimes
effects
thing. You have
thing.
To wear
this
it.
This is not... I'm not saying that... Oh, fuck.
Boom, boom.
Look, I'm not saying this point, is though. A conceptual problem. I understand they made a coffee maker and yeah, I noticed that. But no, what I'm saying is when you went to the large scale world, he should have had clothes on him that were built by the mother of the child in the large scale, which meant his actual clothing should be incredibly stiff and the weave of them should be very large. Like if I get a piece of my old jeans, for example, right, cut them up and make my daughter, well, she's a bit old for this now, but you know, one of my kids' toys, a whatever, not that I can sew, then you see what I'm saying? Like the scale is all wrong because the weave of my jeans looks fine on my leg, but once you put it around somebody as their entire cape or whatever, then the weave is like way out of scale. And we never got that. We never got that between Jack Black and the little people, which is a really good way of indicating scale and shift. We also got it not when Jack Black went to the giant's thing for the baby sequence.
Mm.
I admit that was a funny sequence to a point, but it's just like I felt like this entire dimensionality of scale was just ignored. It was like... Just get over it. You know what I mean? Like, it's like everything. But that would be one of the big things. And even in that film Tooth Fairy, which is by no means, you know, Inception or, you know, Lord of the Rings or whatever, they still went to a lot of trouble that when he went under the pillow or went to the sheets, they had, like, really big prints, really big weave, heavier cloth, like canvas, like a piece of tissue paper to us becomes a piece of canvas. Are you with me on this?
Yeah.
I think I agree with you.
They're bigger fish to fry.
No, but I think you're right, Mike. They could have...
It's going to be a series of large jokes, aren't you?
But they could have used that concept of the weave being the right size as a joke, you know, perhaps more. And because they use props, you know, as jokes, perhaps you're right that they could have played on that a bit more and, you know, made that a bit
sound
of humor.
Like you're hoping for more out of this film than what the poster offers.
No, what I'm doing is what I like to do on the VFX show, which is... If you're going to criticize something, you should be able to articulate where it was something that you think could have been changed. Like if I went to the meeting, the pre-pro meeting, or if I was pitching to do the sequel to this, these are the things that I would bring up, yeah? Like I think if you just say it sucked and stop there, then there's no point in doing the VFX show because then we're just smartasses on the internet.
No. I just don't think this was a particular story device that they really wanted to employ.
But I'm not talking about from a story device point of view. I'm talking about it from a visual effects point of view. Like how do you sell scale? You've taken away the stereoscopic stuff because we're not properly doing the stereo differences between a giant and a... Okay, so what are you left with? There's texture. The next one is depth cueing based on atmospherics and lack of contrast and lack of saturation because obviously if you look at something on the other side of a valley, it's less contrasty, less saturated and less vivid than something that's big and close up. There's obviously soft depth of field. Now, depth of field is a good indicator, but in a world of, you know, F1.4, everything's bloody got a shallow depth of field. So I'm just saying, like, in your arsenal to sell an effect shot, like, you're the supervisor now, right?
Well, what did you think about the shot where he first lands on the island and he stands up and he's actually got the ropes and the other little bits and pieces hanging off his wrist? So, you know, they would have been, I'm guessing, miniature, which were actually tangible things for him to touch. But you also had that shot where it would have been bigotry, where you see the... little people, you know, tying the ropes onto him and stuff like that. I mean, cutting between those two things, I think, worked rather well.
I did think it worked well. I think there's... I was going to finish. The only other thing I think left in your arsenal, which is in that shot, is speed of movement. Because I think in that shot, when he first kind of starts to rear up, he's moving slow and heavy, which gives him weight and speed. For example, why doesn't Jack Black feel big in the end dance sequence? And the reason is because we in no sense get any speed. Like little mice scurry around, right? So we expect the little people on the ground of the dance sequence to have a different physics dynamic than the big Jack Black. So if you're going to make normal time Jack dancing, then the little guys should all be scurrying around and be little thing, kind of like ants. Or you go the other way and you make him do the big lumbering moves, but But it's like they systematically went through and said, well, let's not worry about doing it in terms of speed. Now, the reason I mention that is that's the bit, I think, in the only sequences when he first wakes up, you really felt him lumbering and being big and large.
Yeah.
But the rest of the time, when you had the Lilliputians' view of him, did he not just seem normal and kind of... In no point did he seem big and lumbering, apart from, like, is it the T-shirt that drops on the house and there's one other, I think a shoe drops. But other than that, they didn't sort of have this kind of big weight. Because the thing is, what I'm saying is, if you're watching this in dailies and someone says, this doesn't feel like it's got the right scale, it doesn't feel big enough, one should be able to articulate, well, in my arsenal, these are the tools we have for indicating weight and size, and then narrow down on which ones you feel aren't carrying their weight or you've deliberately decided to ignore. And so if I was sitting in dailies on this, if I was a studio executive, God forbid, looking at this, I'd say, look, I just don't feel we've got enough difference in weight and stuff between the two performances. Now, it could be that you're right, that they just went, none of this, Mike, matters. We just want a funny Jack Black film and just can you just get over this whole scale thing? But as a visual effects guy, you should be at least presenting up to the director, these are your options. These are the things we have in our toolbox to really indicate this massive, massive scale difference between these two guys.
One thing which I was surprised wasn't used with going with the mass thing was the camera shake. You know, when he throws the shirt on the building and when he takes steps close to the camera, I would, you know, if you're a tiny little cameraman in that world, there'd be a bit of shake. There was a tiny bit of atmospherics added when he was wrestling with a robot near the end, just some dust near his feet. But apart from that, you never really got any of that other interaction of particles or anything like that, which I was surprised at.
You should have, I mean, it would be nice to have, in the same way we had the stereo discussion, we touched on the step of the field, it'd be great if every time we were with Jack, it was incredibly hard to keep focus down. Every time we were with the guys looking up, we had every sort of everything fully in focus. But yeah, it'd be nice to have the camera moves more, not only the camera shake, but actually the pivot points of the cameras and everything fully adjusted. So you could do much tighter little turns down at ground level. And up top, you had much more big sweeping turns because the pivot point, it'd be nice if that, it's very rare that a camera is mounted where the optical center of the lens is the point that the camera is on the tripod. So if you do a pan, it's offset. And so big offsets on the top pans would have really been nice. And then, of course, you can get much more pivotal on the ground ones. I totally agree with you.
Maybe that's why the helicopter shots work so well, because it's more of a sweeping...
Well, it was real scale.
Yeah. Mm.
You actually had real scale because, to a certain extent, it was one-to-one on what was going on. Like, you were filming the castle as if Jack was standing there right size. So all your camera moves had... Yeah, it's a good point. It's a very good point.
And I think also what worked for me, although not in every shot, was the robot fight, because I understand that it was shot with a stand-in, you know, on blue screen who had the same mass as that robot, and you kind of felt like Jack Black was interacting with it. Mm. Sometimes the backgrounds weren't always, I think, the right scale, and it might have been a combination of whether they shot using live-action backgrounds or whether they were CG ones or matte paintings, but... You know, I thought that was a pretty fun sequence that kind of worked, especially when you're in the moment and, you know, oh, this is pretty fun, he's fighting a giant robot, you know. And that might go back to your point, Matt, that sometimes you've got to give it away and just remember it's a film and it's just silly.
Who's it for and who's going to buy the shot?
Yeah. So, and I think, you know, Hydraulics did a pretty good job on that.
But there's
those.
A continuum between let's just give it all away and just act it on a stage where we're going to completely accept that when they look over the edge of a cliff, we are meant to imagine the cliff there because clearly they're on a stage in a theatre and some water noises offset are enough to sell the illusion. And in a theatre with a major Hollywood film where I just feel like it's a bit of an excuse to say, well, it's a comedy, nobody cares, move on. Because I think when you do care and you do it well, the audience... I just give a lot of credit to the audience, I guess.
Yeah.
Also, sorry.
No, I was just going to agree. But, yeah, as you said at the beginning, it is a kids' film, and what can you get away with kids' films?
I was just going to say, Mike, that also maybe part of this is that this is an example where some not-so-good visual effects shots take you out of the movie.
Yeah.
Because there's some really, really good stuff in there. And then occasionally there's, I think, some bad comps and some bad eyeline matches.
Can I ask you guys, though, we touched on the robot. I want to go back to this, right? Because I just sat in the audience and watching this with my kids, and I wasn't particularly like trying to be critical or anything else like that. And I just saw the robot sequence, and I just went Wild Wild West. Do you remember Wild Wild West?
Yeah. Will Smith.
Yeah.
Will Smith and Kevin Klein. And it was like Wild Wild West. It was just, you're going to have to obliterate this from your CV. And, I mean, really, like Wild Wild West was just, you know, right up there with films that you just, oh, God, I wish I could get those 90 minutes of my life back. You didn't feel like it was jumping the shark?
No? I've never spent that 90 minutes on Wild Wild West, but I know what you mean. It did have similarities with the robot. Look, the robot stuff was
this is a film well that cost the interior stuff, million back in the day, by the way.
The interior stuff of the robot felt a bit flat, but again, you know, just take it. It's a kid's film.
Yeah, but okay. I just think you're not engaging though. Because I think it's, if you do that, like, well, for a start, like, you've got kids, I've got kids, like, the kids are incredibly media literate, and I just think you're doing them a huge disservice to say it doesn't matter, it's a kid's film. Because my kids, I swear to God, look at shots and go, oh, bad comp. Now, maybe it's because of my kids. Okay, you remember that Batman and Robin film with the director whose name escapes me? It was
Joel Schumacher?
Okay, exactly. I saw an interview with him, and in it, he was like, "They Batman and Robin can do anything because it's just a kid's film and it doesn't matter." And I, at that moment, I hated him. I would almost not see any film that he's ever done. And, you know, if you walked onto the floor of Comic-Con and said that you worked on a Batman and Robin, you could get lynched. I mean, it's, you know, it's horrendous. And I just feel like no one has ever done... I challenge you to name a kid's film that has tried to be really interesting and engaging and quite complex and has suffered as a consequence, because I can name you about 100 or at least a dozen that are kids' films that have been complicated and interesting and Lord of the Ringsy and Harry Potter-esque and gone incredibly well because they didn't underestimate kids. I just think it's wrong to say it doesn't matter, the laws of physics, it can just do whatever you want. And every time someone's done it, like Hulk, like this, like anything, it just, I think it just sells the audience short. Anyway, that's my rant.
Yeah, I still think they had bigger issues in just the appearance.
You're just continuing with the large jokes, aren't you?
No. Yes, it's the scale. The scale just drove me nuts. Things like the depth of field was the number one frustrating, annoying thing with me. The dinner scene where Jack Black is sitting there and you've got the long table in front of him and all the people are sitting there doing the dinner thing. You know, there's some shots there where if you have three people lined up, person closest to camera, soft. Person next to them, in focus. Past them, out of focus, and then you got Jack Black blatantly in focus behind. And I know it's hard to keep the racking of who's important in the scene for the dialogue. And if you're pulling focus in a thing like that, it's going to be really painful, especially in 3D, I imagine, off a dimensionalized image. But still, it just was so frustrating to see that not done well.
Well, have we talked about the Scanline water spout?
No, we haven't.
And I think that was well done. I think that was a really good part of the film. Now, walk us through that, Ian, because obviously Scanline with their proprietary water sim stuff does really good work. But this is quite separate to the stuff we were discussing earlier with the Armada.
It was. I think it worked really well too. You know, that's the scene where Jack Black's on a pleasure boat heading to the Bermuda Triangle and he eventually sees this giant water funnel in this storm, gets sucked into it and wakes up in Lilliput. Scanline used its Flowline system, which runs through 3DS Max, to create both the, you know, raging waters and also this 500-foot funnel. They also shot Jack Black on a dump tank on a sort of boat set in London.
That was on grey in the background, wasn't it, instead of green or blue?
That's right. They used that grey screen for some reason. I think they thought they would get away with a lot of misty and water effects, you know, covering it up. But
from the sounds of things, though, I don't think Scanline got to choose the grey, so they just had to live with it afterwards.
No, and I think they did a pretty good job of extracting him out of that.
The boat, I mean, even Black must have been digital at some point to pull that shot off.
Yeah, that's right.
And it went through pretty quickly, but it was, I thought it was good work.
Yeah. It's sort of a quick three shots, isn't it, when you get sucked in there. But there's, you know, a digital boat and digital blackjack going up the funnel and eventually there's
it's
that sort of close-up
like
on him.
Trailer shots, isn't it? It just had trailer written all over it.
It was. And you know, the other thing
which
is
not
that
a criticism.
No, and what was interesting about it is I think the nature of the shot changed a bit. It was originally going to be a whirlpool type thing, and then, you know, something else sucking him up. And in the end, I'm sort of glad they went with the funnel look because it's quite different.
Yeah, exactly. You want it to be a bit different. It should be original, I think. Yeah, I think, look, we've hopefully tried to stay well away from the plot, but because, you know, but I mean, if you're going to come up with something like the pivotal effect of getting somebody sucking from A to B, it's nice if you, you know, it's a pretty open brief. You can, you know, it's nice to come up with something that looks original and different. And also just does imply that something has happened that it's not easy to get back from.
I think this also touches on why some of the effects might not sell as well. Because you've got production making the decision to shoot these scenes with grey background, and you've got so many changing water funnels and stuff. It doesn't seem like anyone had a clear direction from the beginning. So many delays and stuff. It sounds like all the people who are doing all the effects just had the goalposts switching around on them all the time, or, you know, not much time at all.
Well, that might be true. Yeah, I'm not really sure. But I think, again, I think we've said it, that some shots worked really well and some shots seemed like kind of quick comps and they didn't quite get right. But, you know, there were some standouts, like we talked about the Armada sequence.
Yeah, that was good.
When Gulliver first wakes up in Lilliput, I thought those shots were good. And I like the robot. And I love the opening titles. You know, they just stood out so much.
The director of this, right, was primarily from an animation background, right? Like, Rob has previously done Monsters and Alien City, or I'm pretty sure he just comes from that school of Monsters and Aliens and the stuff at DreamWorks.
Shark Tale, like, and stuff.
Sorry?
Mm. He did Shark Tale as well.
Yeah. So it's a different kind of genre for him. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily expect him to be nailing it. Well, I don't know where it comes in the pipeline, but who was the VFX soup that oversaw all this? Do you know?
Well, during principal photography, it was Jim Rigel, and then Ellen Summers took over about halfway through post-production.
Because Jim knows what he's doing.
That's right, yeah.
I just don't know Ellen. I mean, I'm not saying she doesn't, but I'm just...
And of course, Jim's would have had experience on Lord of the Rings with a few scale issues as well. So, you know, that would have worked. I just feel like you're right. They probably didn't approach all of the scale shots the same. And you could sort of pick out the good ones and pick out the bad ones.
It's a hard thing to do, though.
Mm.
Mm. Well, it's been around for a while. I mean, it's not like we haven't seen this before. But like,
have you ever seen anyone absolutely nail it?
Nail scale?
Yeah, little people versus big people.
Well, I'd say the first time I saw somebody really nail it was the Indian in the Cupboard, which I thought was just freaking awesome.
Yeah.
And that was like way before they had the kind of benefits that these guys had.
Yeah. Good point. And I'd even say, I don't know if you guys remember the Gulliver's Travels miniseries that had Ted Danson in it. You know, TV series.
I do not remember this. I don't even know.
Really?
I know of this.
I think it's back from 1997, and I think Framestore worked on the effects for it.
Really?
And
I thought
you
were going to go with Land of the Giants.
I remember the miniseries being really faithful to the novel. I remember the miniature effects, and also when Gulliver becomes small, those also working really well. And, you know, that's 1997, or if I've got the year right. I thought Night at the Museum worked well with scale effects.
That was pretty good.
Apart from some of those things, there were a couple of things I think that weren't quite up to. I mean, it's difficult. It's actually really difficult to actually make convincing props even. Like, I mean, I think that's one of the biggest problems you get is that you hand somebody a fake pencil, I don't know, like a match at these big scale outputs. I mean, I thought the iPod looked like it was, or the iPhone looked like it was about the right scale, but I presume that was a digital stand-in. But yeah, anything like a wooden match or something is really hard to make that sort of scale look like it's the right scale.
Mm. Sell the texturing to the correct scale and stuff.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I don't think that's... Like, it's a hard problem for props, and I'm not even 100% sure... Well, you know, I don't know. Maybe if you did a lot of macro photography work, you could come up with some really good reference and stuff. But, I think it's just the physical problem of making something at the big scale. It looks like it's real and not sort of paper mache.
I think I'd rather take on a film where everyone's on fire rather than big people versus little people.
Really? Really? People on fire. Okay. Well, because it'd be all digital or?
I don't know. It just seems to be better ways of getting across the line from what you see on the screen. You see a lot more people burning on fire and go, oh, I believe that, rather than big people versus little people.
Right. Okay.
That's just me.
Hey, was Jim on Narnia, we mentioned earlier? Jim Rigel?
I think what happened with Narnia was that he was working with the director, Michael Apted, you know, when it was still a Disney film.
Okay.
And they'd spent a couple of years or months, you know, scouting and that sort of thing. And then it turned into a Fox film and, yeah, it changed after that.
Okay. Yeah. Because he actually was also second unit, I'm just looking this up, second unit director on Night at the Museum, the first one. You know, we always mentioned his Lord of the Rings stuff. Yeah, and if, speaking of people on fire, he also worked on Silver Surfer, didn't he? With people that were literally on fire. You know, Rise of the Silver Surfer? Because of the, you know, the firework that they did in that. Well, I guess the takeout for us is it's patchy. I think there's a big missed opportunity with the stereography that you could have been just breaking immensely cool ground like they did in the title sequence. The companies involved are all good companies, right? So, I mean, you know, this patchiness we're talking about is a little hard to nail down. I mean, and as you say, like each of them delivered some really great shots. That scanline shots of the water were great. The stuff with the, I liked certainly of the running through at the roof level. One thing we didn't discuss, and I thought it bothered me, and I think it probably just bothered me creatively, is the recreation of Times Square with his personalized kind of billboarding stuff going on. Did anybody else find that slightly weird?
Do you mean from just part of the film sort of thing?
No, I don't. I'm trying to separate the creative from the visual. Mm. It seemed like it was a big ask for a small joke, and so it wasn't completed at maybe same kind of polish level that we saw in some of the other things.
Well, they went down and they did scans of the London banking district to recreate the buildings in the background and stuff. And visually, I think effects-wise, it worked well. But, yeah, giant billboards of Jack Black doing all that other crap, I don't know. It was.
My kids thought that was funny.
Really?
Yeah, I just didn't. So do you know what the final shot count was?
I don't actually know.
It must have been up like 1,200 or something.
I think it was meant to be much less. And, of course, as these films do, it grew.
Right.
It grew to a very large number.
Well, obviously, we're not privy to what happened behind the scenes, but you have, in fact, written up a story on this, which will be coming out about the time this podcast done. So I'm looking forward to reading that on Gulliver's Travels, which will be on FX Guide in the new site. And there should be bonus material available to you if you're part of FX Guide Insider. If you want to find out more about FX Guide Insider, please, by all means, jump right in and have a look at it. It's on the new FX Guide site. Also, if you've got any feedback that you'd like to send us here for us on the VFX show, please send us an email. You can contact us via vfx@fxguide.com, just vfx@fxguide.com. We'd love to hear from you, as a lot of people do write into us. With the new site, we've got a new sort of slightly tighter email address, so you can get in touch with us. Or you can just obviously leave comments and stuff in the quick take section. Thank you guys for being with us. Are you guys, where's the best place to follow you? And you've obviously full-time here at FX Guide, but you also have your own site, VFX Blog, which is still running hot.
It is, yeah. It's vfxblog.com, and that's also my Twitter address, vfxblog, and I just tend to post a lot of links around the web about visual effects articles and happenings, and yeah, that's where you can find me.
And Matt, you mainly hang out on Facebook rather than the Twitters.
Not so much on the Twitters, but you know, I'm always floating around the forums of FXPhD, but I am working on a site which will one day be finished. One day. Random gibberish and
I didn't even know you had a website you were doing.
Oh, slowly but surely.
Okay, I look forward to seeing it. Obviously, you can find me at Mike Seymour on Twitter, or of course, just at FX Guide, which is the best place. Hey, thanks so much for being with us this week. Coming up, we have some great shows. I believe the next one is Green Hornet, and I'm looking at people are nodding as I say I'm saying this, which is a Michel Gondry film, which I think will be really, really interesting. I think Jason Wingrove is keen to join us for that one, as is Jason Diamond. So hopefully, that's coming out real soon. I haven't seen the film yet. I'm about to see it thanks to a press screening, but I'll hold my judgment until I see it. Anything by Michel Gondry is worth a look. Until next time, I'm Mike Simwell. Thanks so much for listening. See you.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2011 FX Guide, LLC.